Chair calls the Minnesota House Public Safety and Criminal Justice Reform, Finance and Policy Division to order. Good afternoon, members, and to the public gathered here today. Very well. Members, today we're going to have continue our conversation on probation. We're going to hear two bills, one from Representative Long and the other from Representative O'Neill. And members, as you know, we have been focused throughout this week and the prior weeks on community-centered public safety. And part of the elements that community-centered public safety brings to us is the ability to engage with the resources that are available throughout the entire community to be able to play an important role in advancing public safety and advancing it in terms of working with people in the correction system to be able to reclaim their lives and reclaim their ability to make our entire state, our entire community whole and good and restored. And within that spirit, that I welcome the testifiers here today, and then I welcome these two bills. So with that, we're going to begin our discussion today with a presentation on the Sentencing Guidelines Commission and Probation by the Rubina Institute. And Dr. Kelly Mitchell, I think, is here. If she can come forward and begin our conversation with us today, that'd be terrific.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have to correct the record. I wish I was a doctor, just a JD.
I tried.
Every time I come, you increase my stature. I love it. Thank you for having me. I am Kelly Mitchell. I'm the executive director of the Rubina Institute of Criminal Law and Criminal Justice at the University of Minnesota. I'm here today to give you a short presentation, a little bit of background on mandates that different sentencing commissions have across the country and probation guidelines and how those could potentially work within the context of sentencing guidelines. And the sort of reason that I've been asked to do that is because of House File 997, which is before you today. And two of the things that that bill does is that it would actually expand the mandate of the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission to require the commission to collect, analyze, and report on probation outcomes and recidivism, and it would direct the commission to develop probation guidelines. When you look at the text of your bill, like, these two things happen in reverse order from the way I'm going to talk about them. Sort of page one and the top of page two is the probation guidelines piece, and then the rest of the bill deals with the mandate of the commission. So I'll talk first about commission mandates. There are, in a moment, I'm going to show you a map of all the sentencing commissions that currently exist across the U.S., and there are two main types of sentencing commissions. The first type is established primarily to develop, implement, and monitor some form of sentencing guidelines. The second type is created to focus on the development and analysis of sentencing or criminal justice policy. And you don't have to be one or the other. There are commissions that do a mix of both things. But what we find is that the commissions that are a bit older, that have been around a little bit longer, tend to focus more on sentencing guidelines, and the commissions that are newer tend to be the ones that have broader mandates and tend to work in broader areas. And I'll demonstrate that. I'll tell you more about that in a moment. So this is a map of all of the commissions that currently exist across the country. So you can see that those that are light blue are the sentencing commissions or criminal justice commissions that exist with a broad mandate to work on criminal justice policy. Often these are commissions that are tasked with taking issues up between legislative sessions and helping to work on the issues for the legislature and provide them with recommendations. There's actually one commission missing from here. Nevada actually created a commission about a year ago. I was honored to go down there before they created that commission to work with top officials in the state who were interested in creating a commission, then I was honored to go back and present at their very first meeting last year to talk to them about what they were there to do. So I'll give you some examples. Connecticut was formed in 2011. That's a light blue, one of the little squares over on the eastern coast there. They were formed in 2011, and they have a very broad mandate. Their enabling legislation does require them to consider whether guidelines would be appropriate for the state. But right now, they don't see that as the most pressing issue that they want to work on. And so their commission is focused on broader issues, everything from pretrial release to sex offender management. They've done it all. Alaska is also a light blue color. And Alaska actually was one of the older commissions. And so they were originally formed to create guidelines. They did that. Those guidelines were actually became their determinate sentencing system that's been enacted into statute. And then they kind of dissolved. And then they were reconstituted a few years ago with a very broad mandate. And that commission actually helped draft a bill that had sweeping reforms in Alaska that covered issues all ranging from bail to probation and parole violations up to reentry. So they sort of swept the whole gamut, and they also recommended new sentence lengths to the legislature that were enacted. Pennsylvania, on the other hand, is dark blue, and they were actually, that commission was formed the same year that Minnesota's commission was formed. So they are a much older commission, and they're a little bit more like Minnesota in that their primary mission is to review and maintain sentencing guidelines. But one of the differences with that commission is they are connected to Penn State, and so they actually have a really robust research agenda as well. And they put out a lot of research reports. They work on the impact of guidelines. They work on recidivism. Right now they're working on developing a risk assessment tool to be used in conjunction with sentencing as a tool for the judge not to decide the sentence. So if we look across the mandates that establish, if we look across the statutes that establish the mandates for all these commissions, these are the core purposes that stand out. These are the ones that tend to be in everybody's statute. Sentencing commissions are often formed to, create guidelines or inform the legislature about sentencing policy and practices, to protect public safety, manage correctional resources. That's what one of the big functions of our commission. Maintain judicial discretion in sentencing, avoid disparity, increase equity and fairness in sentencing, and achieve certainty in sentencing. So Minnesota was one of the very first sentencing commissions ever created, as I mentioned, and it produced the first statewide set of commission-developed sentencing guidelines in the nation. And because creating those guidelines was such a tremendous effort, a monumental task at the time, since it hadn't been done, I think that the commission's focus early on became very centered on the upkeep and continued maintenance of those guidelines. But if you look at the language of the mandate that's actually reproduced in the bill that you have in front of you today, I think the current mandate is actually broad enough to cover a variety of criminal justice issues. And in fact, the commission is it states explicitly that the commission can review criminal laws and rules and make recommendations about changes that should be made. And they have engaged in work over the years that has led to broader policy discussions. So for example, in the 1990s, the commission provided some of the underlying research on racial disparity in sentencing that was used and examined by the Racial Bias Task Force put on by the judicial branch, which some of you may know. Just had its 25th anniversary last year. There was an event last week to talk about where we are. In 2007, the commission sort of went in a whole new direction, and they staffed the Collateral Sanctions Committee that was created by the legislature. So we have a pool of expertise in our sentencing commission, and on many levels, it makes a lot of sense to tap that expertise as we continue to talk about how to solve this probation issue. So in that respect, the bill is simply asking the commission to do what it does best, which is collect and analyze data. That's really what it comes down to in terms of expanding their mandate on pages 2 and 3. Minnesota prides itself on its low imprisonment rate, as we talked about yesterday in the hearing. And we've been able to maintain that in part because we have good information about who receives prison sentences and what happens to them. But we don't have that same level of information about parole. So part of what you're looking at in the bill today is whether we should do something so that we have that same level of information for probation sentences. I said parole, I meant probation. So if we look at the... this is, you can't even read it. I hope you all have copies in front of you. If you look at these are four of the principles that underlie the sentencing guidelines. These are printed in the first section of the sentencing guidelines today. Number 3 there, it says that the severity of the sanction should increase in direct proportion to an increase in offense severity and the convicted felon's criminal history or both. This promotes a rational and consistent sentencing policy. So that's what the guidelines are designed to do. I'm not going to put up numbers you've already seen on the probation issue. We've seen that we have a lot of variation in the probation sentences that are meted out. We've seen that variation across when we look at, when we take all the offenses together, and we've seen that variation when we look across judicial districts. This is the variation you haven't seen yet, and this goes directly to that paragraph I just read. There's also variation by severity level and criminal history score. So the bar on the left is average probation terms by severity level. And so I think what we would expect to see here is that we would expect to see the probation term get longer as the severity level gets higher. And one thing, this is the standard grid, so there are 3 grids in Minnesota. This is just the folks who are sentenced on the standard grid, which I think you might have a copy of. There are 11 severity levels. I did not include severity levels 10 and 11 because nobody gets probation at that level. But I did go up to severity level 9, and what we are seeing is that there's kind of an upward pattern, but at severity levels 7 and 8, the numbers go back down again. And so I'm not exactly sure why that's happening. At severity level 7, some folks are still recommended for presumptive probation. At severity level 8, nobody is. All of those should be prison sentences. So it's interesting that the average terms that individuals are receiving are actually lower at severity level 8 than 6. The other graph is average probation terms by criminal history score, and it's those with a 0 criminal history score actually have a higher average than those with a criminal history score of 5 or 6. I would kind of expect to see that. If you do look at the grid, you'll see that probation's recommended at a criminal history score of 0, pretty high up, right? So it goes up to severity level 7. So, you'd expect that if you take the average in, thinking that as severity level increases, the probation term might also increase, you'd expect the overall average for people at criminal history score 0 to be a little bit higher. There's not many people over at criminal history score 5 that are recommended for probation. But what concerns me is that the average here is 64 months. And most people actually, if you were to plot people where they fall in the grid, they mostly fall into rows 2 and 4, which have pretty low, probation terms already. So what that means is that the folks in the criminal history score of 0, there are averages that are really high that are pulling that number up. So that means we still have a significant number of people getting the higher criminal history scores at the higher longer probation terms at a criminal history score of 0. So these are the kinds of things that the commission would look at if it were tasked with setting probation guidelines. They would start with these kinds of numbers, and they would probably work to even it out and come up with a number that might make sense by severity level and criminal history score. I wanted to show you that a couple of other sentencing commissions have taken on this task and have incorporated probation into their guidelines. It's not that common. There's really, I can only think of four guidelines that actually do incorporate probation to some degree. This first grid here is Oregon, and just like ours, that really dark bolded line is the dividing line between prison and probation. They reverse the order of their severity levels, so for them, one is a lower severity level, 11 is high. And then, so the folks that are, underneath that bar should be recommended for probation. The folks that are above it should be recommended for prison. And then you'll see that the columns next to the grid, the first column is what the probation term should be if that person is sentenced to probation. The second column is if the court were to depart and give a longer term, this is the maximum amount of time that they could add on. So they also address that issue. The third column is for post-prison release. Anyone who is given a prison sentence would also have this post-prison release term added onto their sentence. So that's the way Oregon does it. And Oregon actually has a cap of 5 years set in statute, and then the commission worked within that cap to create these probation terms. This is Kansas, and they, have a very similar setup to Oregon, where they also put probation in those columns to the right of their grid. And here you'll actually see Kansas. They like to replicate Kansas and Oregon like to do a lot of things alike. So the criminal history score looks really similar. There's a lot of things about their grids that are really similar. So are the numbers. So are the lengths of probation. The difference in Kansas is they're not working within a specific cap. The way it works in Kansas is their sentencing guidelines are statutory. So the commission developed these probation terms, and then they became enacted enacted into statute. So now they are law. But there are provisions in law that allow in both systems that allow the court to enact a longer probation term if that's necessary. In Oregon, a longer term would be a departure. They would actually have to make the same findings that they do for any other departure. And I told you about there's a limit on how much they could add on. In Kansas, it's not a departure. So they've taken a little bit of a different approach there. They give the judge the ability to add on more time, but this is more at the violation stage. So the initial sentence has to be within that cap that we saw, and then there's a violation where they might add on time. Did we want to?
Ms. Mitchell, we have a question from the same.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Ms. Mitchell. I was wondering about that, if that was considered departures, and how what would concern me is that if we did that here, then we'd have to go through the whole Blakely proving those facts beyond a reasonable doubt, and we have to give notice in advance of that, and sometimes some of those factors might be not something we would know about at the time we're, before trial or before a guilty plea. And so I'm just curious how Kansas then sort of avoids the Blakely situation. If you know, it's very in the weeds.
Ms. Mitchell.
Chair Mariani and Representative Mueller, you've stumped me.
Sorry.
I can't believe it. Yeah, you're right. That's an excellent question. I will actually ask and get back to you. I know the director there. But Kansas, you're right, Kansas is like Minnesota. Their guidelines are mandatory, so they are subject to Blakely. Not every guideline system is, mm-hmm. But so there has to be some sort of a provision. And I'm going to guess, using my legal hat, 5-second analysis, I'm going to guess that because this is after the fact, that this is not happening at the time of sentencing, that this is happening on the violation hearing, I'm going to guess it might not be subject to Blakely. But I'll ask that question.
Thank you. Thanks.
Yeah. Is that it? Last slide. I just wanted to say, so both I mentioned that both have ways to increase the amount of time that a person would serve on probation. And then there are, a couple of other rules that might apply. These are the ones that are easy to find. There could be others I'm not aware of that operate in that system as well. But in Oregon, the 5-year cap doesn't apply to sex offenders, so those individuals could have longer probation terms. And they do have a special rule that the time on probation would toll if the individual absconds in Kansas. The court has the ability to extend probation, similar to what we heard yesterday here, for non-payment of restitution and child support. And then, let's see. Oh, and they also have a rule that if there's multiple probation terms, they have to run concurrent. They can't run consecutive. And so that's it. I hope that that's helpful and gives you a little bit of a sense of, I guess the main points I wanted to bring here is it's not unreasonable for the Sentencing Commission to have a broader mandate than it does today, to expand it a bit more, to do a few more operations. And if probation guidelines are something this committee is interested in, that they've been done elsewhere, it can be done. One thing I do want to emphasize, too, is that this particular bill that you're going to be hearing today can work either with or as an alternative to the bill that you heard yesterday. So I mentioned that Oregon was the example where they have a cap, and then the guidelines that are with the probation guidelines work within that cap. So that's possible. Kansas goes the other way. They don't have that cap. So either or both could happen. And with that, I'll stand for questions.
Thank you, Ms. Mitchell. I have to say I'm struck by the earlier when you shared the Minnesota grid and analysis of you know, our probationary experience, where you know, it seemed that the more severe the offense doesn't necessarily mean that there's more probation time relative to a lesser offense. I suspect that's probably not the way most of the public thinks things work in Minnesota. And of course, yesterday, I want to be a little careful because I don't know the full history of the testifier, Ms. Schroeder, who was convicted of a nonviolent offense and is serving a 40-year probation, experiencing a 40-year probation period. And so it may be an outlier, I don't know, but it certainly begs the question about who should be thinking about this, who should be recalibrating, and what our role here is relative to making that happen. And I do appreciate your counsel here, and we're going to hear a little bit more in the following testifiers as well about the scope and expectation of our Sentencing Commission in this regard. We have a question from Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani, I was just wondering if you could have staff email ES presentation to the members and staff.
Representative Johnson, absolutely. And I believe it is being posted online, but as a request from a committee member, we'll get those directly out to you all. Very well. Are any any questions of Ms. Mitchell? Thank you so much for your testimony today.
Thank you.
With that, members, we're going to move into. Thank you. I hit it here. House File 997, Representative Long. And members, I do want to share that we have invited the Sentencing Guideline Commissioners to be with us in this conversation today. So if any commissioners are in the audience, please let me know, and we'll make sure that the public knows that you're here. I happen to know one commissioner is here because our corrections commissioner serves on the sentencing guidelines, and we'll be hearing from Commissioner Schnell in a little bit. But we obviously want to make sure that there's a strong communications happening between this body and this committee and our guidelines commission. Representative Long moves that House File 997 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. And Representative Long, you have a A1 amendment. Is that correct?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm move 997 as you suggested to be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. And then I'm sorry,
it's an A, it's a 0028 or A19-0028 amendment. Does that jive with your?
Yes, it is. And I would like to move the A19 amendment as well to have the bill in the form that I would like it before the committee. It's fairly straightforward. It strikes shall and inserts may. The original list of non-institutional sanctions that the Sentencing Guideline Commission can consider includes some dated concepts. The latest language hasn't been updated from 1978. For example, it includes a reference to day fines, which is not something that we are currently using. So this allows the commission the flexibility to reference them or not reference them as it chooses.
Very well. All in favor of the A19-0028 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Your bill is amended before us, Representative Long. And you have testifiers, I believe, as well.
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for having me back for day two of a probation week. And this bill deals with a related topic, but a separate approach to the bill we heard yesterday. Consistency is a fundamental principle of our justice system. It promotes transparency and accountability. It adds legitimacy to the court system. If you go back to 18th century Europe, reformers were pushing to establish consistent sentencing because they were challenging a system that was viewed by many as arbitrary and unfair. If you fast forward a couple centuries to 1970s Minnesota, reformers were raising similar concerns. And in 1978, Minnesota created the nation's first Sentencing Guidelines Commission. Then in 1980, Minnesota became the first state to implement a sentencing guidelines structure. To put that in context, that was the year before I was born. So Minnesota has a lot to be proud of, and in no small part due to this legacy of being a first mover. But as we discussed in detail yesterday, there's a glaring hole of unfairness in our state system when it comes to probation. Our committee heard testimony about the regional disparities we face in our probation system. In some parts of Minnesota, the average probation length is 3 years, while in others it is 7 years. We are failing the basic test that those convicted of the same crime should receive similar punishment. For this reason alone, we need to standardize our probation system. We also still have extreme probation sentences, like the 40 years that Jennifer Schroeder testified in front of our committee about that she received for her nonviolent drug sentence. We are currently only providing guidance to courts on a portion of the punishment that we are delivering as a state. And I believe it is time to ask a trusted Minnesota institution, the Sentencing Guidelines Commission, to put its resources and collective wisdom towards tackling the challenge of probation. The bill before us would require the commission to establish guidelines for probation. Discretion would be left to the commission to consider offense and offender characteristics, as it does with incarceration. To be clear, the commission currently has this authority to establish appropriate guidelines for probation, but it's had 41 years. And hasn't taken action yet. As Director Mitchell mentioned, other states with a grid for sentencing also have incorporated probation, such as Kansas and Oregon. And I believe a nudge from this committee and the legislature is appropriate, given our current understanding of the challenges the state is facing in this area. The bill would also expand the commission's data collection responsibilities to include specific probation data. These are probation terms, recidivism, revocations, and conditions of probation. And I've heard consistently from all stakeholders who are involved in probation that there's a real need for more data, and this will assist with its collection. I view this bill as complementary to the 5-year probation cap we heard yesterday. We have in the past given the commission guidance about maximum sentences, but also allowed them to establish recommendations within those maximums for the sake of consistency. And I believe in the probation context, this would work well for this pairing. And unless there are questions for me, I'm happy to move forward to bring the presenters.
Why don't we do that?
Okay. First will be Commissioner Schnell.
Welcome back to the committee, Commissioner Schnell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I first of all want to say thank you to Representative Long and all the members of the committee for bringing some attention to this issue. I'm in a little bit of an unusual position here because I wear two hats, one as the Commissioner of Correction and one as one member of the Sentencing Guidelines Commission. So I want to be really clear about the fact that I do not speak for the body of the Sentencing Guidelines Commission. That said, as Commissioner of Corrections and certainly as an individual member of Sentencing Guidelines, I am concerned about issues of disparity and fairness around probation terms. I think that should be a fundamental fairness and justice question for all of us. Ultimately, it shouldn't be based upon which county you live in when you are being sentenced for these crimes. And we can simply look at the distinction between this county and the county to the west. And looking at terms of being 38 months, we look at all offenses for probation terms in Hennepin County versus 67 in this particular county. And I think as a body, as a community, I think as Representative Long talked about, it is incumbent upon us to make sure that there is fundamental fairness around this and that these probation terms link with what evidence tells us about what works and what doesn't. And that ultimately we really focus most heavily on defining and being clear about what works, what's effective in terms of probation terms, and how it is that we assist people to do well while they're on probation to become fully active and pro-social members of our community. So I would stand for any questions, but certainly we stand behind and I think want to recognize the fact that fairness becomes a fundamental and core issue around my personal support of this and my role as a Sentencing Guidelines Commissioner, of having the Commission look at this at the same time on the broader level, as the Commissioner of Corrections, I think it is important and critical that we address this fairness issue across the board. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Schnell. I think you made your values quite clear here, and obviously, knowing you, they're rooted in many years of experience. You heard Representative Long earlier state that he thought that the commission does have the ability under law to create guidelines for probation. Do you share that that thought as well?
Mr. Chair, committee members, I will tell you that I'm not a lawyer, and that's probably a good thing.
I
think just broadly reading the language, it appears that way. Again, I defer to people who I think have a whole lot more of the background, but based on the language as I've read from a plain language standpoint, it does appear that the Guidelines Commission does have some ability to explore and look at this issue.
Thank you. And as I claimed for you earlier, I thought you expressed, in addition to that, your own sense of values in terms of it ought to have that authority as well. Are there any questions for the commission? If not, then thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I appreciate it. Representative Long.
I'm going to call up my next two presenters, Ben Feist with ACLU and Lars Nickstad with ISAIAH.
Very well. Please come forward.
And for the committee's knowledge, there's two following this, so we won't have quite as many as yesterday.
It's all about quality, Representative Long, not quantity.
Well, they're all quality.
Yes. No argument here.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ben Feist. I'm the legislative director of the ACLU of Minnesota.
Welcome for those, to the committee, Mr. Feist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, for those who are not familiar with the ACLU, we are a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization dedicated to protecting the civil liberties of all Minnesotans under the U.S. and federal constitutions. And we do this work through lobbying, through litigation and community engagement. We currently have over 40,000 members throughout the state of Minnesota. So I'm testifying today in support of House File 997. We did not have the opportunity to testify yesterday regarding our strong support of the five-year probation cap in House File 689, but I did want to put that on the record as well. We think that's a great idea. Probation is a key contributor to mass incarceration. Through widening the net of people in criminal justice, in the criminal justice system, keeping individuals under correctional control for lengthy periods of time, and the overutilization of probation revocations. The amount of time that a person spends on probation should be limited to the time needed to achieve rehabilitation, accountability, and public safety. As we've already heard, our current probation system in sentencing practices results in disparities based on geographic location rather than an individual's risk and needs. As the Sentencing Guidelines Commission can and should have a role in addressing issues in our probation system. In particular, the Commission is well suited to look into the issues of the regional and racial disparities in probation rates, as it does effectively with other sentencing issues. In order to address over-incarceration in Minnesota, we need to better understand the role of probation sentences and revocations. This bill simply emphasizes that the Guidelines Commission has the appropriate expertise and mission to delve further into this important topic. To be clear, this bill is not a substitute for legislative action on the needed 5-year probation cap, but it will encourage the Commission to dive deeper into the role of probation in our criminal justice system, and we certainly believe that is much needed right now. With that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Feist. Why don't we hear from Mr. Neckstad as well, and then we'll open it up for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Lars Neckstad. I'm the policy director for ISAIAH. ISAIAH is a statewide organization of people of faith working for racial and economic justice. I come today not as an expert in criminal justice or as a certainly not as a lawyer, but to speak out of our values of mercy and redemption, and that we all fall short at some point, and no one should forever be judged by their worst act. We believe we are all spiritually diminished when we succumb to punitive instincts rather than strive for redemption and reconciliation. I'd like to also support the bill that came forward yesterday, which we did not testify on, but we support the notion of a cap. Some of the discussion this week about probation has pointed out that Minnesota is indeed better than many other states when it comes to incarceration rates, but I'd like to note that when you compare our incarceration rates to the rest of the world, we are actually quite a bit of an outlier. Canada has a lower incarceration rate, as do about 150 other countries, including countries on every continent. So we're already an outlier on incarceration. We're a further outlier, as we've heard, on probation. And we appreciate this committee's attention to this issue and Representative Long's bill. From the summary from House Research on House File 997, there is a sentence, the enacting statute stated that a primary goal of the sentencing guidelines is to maintain uniformity, proportionality, rationality, and predictability in sentencing. Yet from the presentation of Ms. Mitchell earlier in front of this committee, you can see that the average probation sentence in the second district, which is Ramsey County, is nearly 6 years, while the average probation sentence in the fourth judicial district, which is Hennepin County, is about 3 years. So that's a pretty jarring distinction, and it's, you know, it's hard to read those statistics for the average person because it's the second district and the fourth district, and it's in months, but just that 3 years versus 6 years, depending on which side of the river you live on, seems irrational and far from uniform. I did follow some of the ECC work group, the Earned Compliance Credit Work Group, that was convened and mentioned in yesterday's hearing. And one phrase stuck with me from that. A probation officer said that even a good probation officer runs out of things to say after about 5 or 10 years. The other note that I'm sorry I haven't been able to find the source and the data on this, but I believe workload and caseloads on probation officers has dramatically increased over the last 10 or 20 years. And so the amount of attention that probation officers can give to each client has diminished because of that. So that's something that I would encourage you to look at. My experience from observing the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission is they've taken some laudable steps in the right direction. It feels like it's taken an enormous amount of advocacy and cajoling to get them to do that. We think that this bill is a good push in the right direction for them to add probation into the sentencing grid. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Mr. Nexted. I am struck by both of your affiliations with your organizations that there are energies that are focused on civil rights and have concerns about the state of our probation terms in our state, and that there are faith communities that also share those concerns. I'm particularly struck, Mr. Nexted, you know, I'm new to chairing this committee, and so I'm on a rapid learning curve. One of the things I've learned, I guess I knew about it, but I'm struck by the deep involvement of a diversity of faith communities working with people in our corrections system. Whole communities have insisted on not giving up on their fellow citizens and who are coming forward in the way you're coming forward and representing Isaiah to express the desire for a policy change relative to this issue. It says something I think mighty strong about good values in the state of Minnesota. Representative Law, are there any questions for our testifiers? If not, thank you, gentlemen. Representative Law.
I'd like to invite up my last two presenters, Dr. Raj with the NAACP and Gina Evans with the Teen Challenge and Second Chance Coalition.
Welcome to the committee, Dr. Raj, and Ms. Evans, I look forward to your testimony.
Thank you. I have no idea what the formal greeting is. Hi, everybody.
That works.
How's everybody doing? Okay, good. Thank you for the opportunity to speak in front of you. I've got just a few points just to remind us. The history of the sentencing guidelines starts in 1978, but
Dr. Raj, I apologize. We need to do this. We have to have every testifier state their name for the record.
Okay.
Because we take these.
Oh, say my name, Raj. Last name is Sid Raju. Is that cool? Okay.
That works. Thank you, Dr. Raj. I apologize for the interruption.
No, I'm sorry. I'm not too formal here, so I apologize. Thank you all for accepting my informalities here. As I said, you know, when we think about the sentencing guidelines, we have to realize that in 1970, those who were incarcerated at large in the United States of America were about 300,000 people, right? And you look in 2010, 2011, you have about 2.1 million people incapacitated in our system. And as a result of the pronounced need to control the population, and especially those who were disenfranchised, communities of color were disenfranchised and were trapped in our system in the name of public safety. And that led to us, Minnesota, right, the liberal, nice, wonderful Minnesota, to figure out what are we doing, because we have a five-fold increase in our sentencing since 1978. And at 1978, we passed this particular sentencing guideline commission that examined, and their charge was to, proportional, right, figure out proportional offenses, culpability, and the crime, and eliminate disparities, be rational and consistent, right, treat prison beds as a scarce resource, not as a economic benefit. And yet, we know that is what has happened. It is no longer a scarce resource, our prison beds. They have become a way of intensifying job opportunities in our community. So we have turned this tide into an economic opportunity. And I'm hopeful that the sentencing guideline, as was the grid, as was put out there, gives us a sense of who is trapped in the system. And if we are spending $35,000 a year, right, to maintain one individual in our system, then how would that $35,000, if invested back in our community, what would that produce? For every dollar that is spent inside a prison system, what would that translate in our community? So I want to invite us to think about the ways that we can manage this particular spending that we have started, and in the name of sentencing people, incapacitating people in our system, and allowing them to thrive in our community, finding ways to address this particular sentencing guideline grid, right, that has been put together and now being practiced or invited to be practiced by our judges in our court systems. And then also understanding that much of this grid is also pushed or sometimes compensated or sometimes compromised as a result of the power of the county attorneys. Right? So this particular bill doesn't address how county attorneys impose themselves on making sure that certain crimes get a certain amount of punishment and others have an opportunity to walk out of the system and fight the system. So I want to kind of invite us to think about those things, right? And also the other component that I want to stress on is this concept and construct that in criminology that we are talking about incarceration, right? Sentencing guidelines now has led to more and more people being walking around with monitors on their ankles and all places. And these are starting with 10-year-olds and 12-year-old kids all the way to adults. And this has become spun an industry, an entire industry that is living off incarceration, right? Electronic monitoring has become a reality. And one other point just to really stress is this is what in criminology we call not mass incarceration, but mass forms of punishment. And Michelle Alexander pointed out when she was here to speak, because initially when she was invited, she said, why would I go to Minnesota, the most progressive state? But then when she dug down into some of the data of people who are on our probation and parole, then she realized that there is such disproportionality and the immense weight of probation, right, has been disproportionately distributed to communities of color, right, especially African American and Native American communities. And so we want to kind of ask you to think about how sentencing guideline needs to be couched in a way that also addresses the needs of our community, as not just simply the weight of, okay, let's be nice, let's do five years top probation, and then let's also address sentencing guidelines according to the kinds of the crimes that has been listed here, not based on the needs of our community. Right? So I want to invite us to think and humanize the process as opposed to dehumanize and remove ourselves and just simply live based on the grid. Right? Appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Raj. So yesterday, I believe you were here yesterday, we heard about concerns around disparities. They were primarily framed in terms of regional characteristics. And I believe Mr. Godfrey shared that with drug offenses across the board, cumulatively, we have a state where there's an 82-month difference in terms of an average probationary term for those offenses. It took me by surprise that in one state we would have that kind of regional disparity. I think what I hear you saying, adding to that today, is that there are other disparities here. And so I'm wondering if perhaps you can expound a little bit about that.
In terms of disparities, right, so the way offenses are managed and sentencing disparities exist, but it is also weighted towards communities of color, right? Communities of color disproportionately get more punishment and more times of stay within our prison systems or within the probation and parole systems that we have set up in the name of public safety. So when you say disproportionality exists, it exists also in the context of who is our children who are being suspended, right? Largely, our children who are suspended are children of color, right? And you also have children who are taken out and classified as level four schools. They are now put in level four schools as opposed to level one or level two, whatever those lower levels schools. So disproportionality exists in schools and the way our children are classified, and then disproportionality exists in terms of who is weighted down by probation and parole and by monitors that monitor every one of their moves. And if you don't report, don't pay your fines or get to the probation office at a certain time, all of these things disproportionately affects communities of color who have less access to resources that is needed. So if your probation office is set up in Minnetonka and you have to come from North Minneapolis, right, just the sheer travel business is overwhelming. And you have to take an entire day off to counter and to be responsible for your action, right? So you are now losing out on the income of the day. So in that context, there are lots of disparities that exist. And then just to belabor this point, communities of color have more are used as an example of public safety and how well we are doing in public safety in this country by just simply saying that we have more people of color on electronic monitoring. Right, that also exists within our and yes, Hennepin County may have a lower level of charge, but let's not forget there are a lot more people of color who are in probation in Hennepin County, and they are and weighted down by warrants also, right? And the warrant forgiveness day that NAACP and ACLU do, Hennepin County refuses to participate in community-wide warrant forgiveness day, because they are afraid that people will take advantage of just coming to those community-wide warrant forgiveness day as opposed to going to the courts, right? They have 11,000 outstanding warrants a year in Hennepin County, about 8,000 to 9,000 outstanding warrants in Ramsey County, about 8,000 in Dakota County. But those are, and they are weighted, that weighs communities of color down too. So that's another disproportionality in terms of who has warrants and who doesn't.
Thank you, Dr. Raj. I do appreciate the call for to humanize the process and to ask the question what the needs of our communities are relative to this. I'm going to turn it over to your colleague now, Ms. Evans. State your name for the record, and please give us your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Gina Evans, and I serve as the Director of Outreach for Minnesota Adult and Teen Challenge, as well as the Vice President for the Minnesota Second Chance Coalition. Mr. Chair, if you're interested in the actual data, the Sentencing Guideline Commission put together a report in 2016 when we worked on the sentencing guideline drug reforms. I know they pulled that data, and that was one of the charts that was part of that report if you wanted to see the actual disparity by race.
Thank you,
that data is available.
Thank you, Ms. Evans. I'll have my staff pull that up and share it out with committee members as well. Thank you.
Yeah. So, you know, it's really sad for me to say, and I think back on it now, and if it wasn't as important as it is for me to talk about it, I would be ashamed of it. But the conversation that you guys are having about probation reform and caps, I think I speak to the other side of that. I've been convicted of 13 felony convictions. All of them but one were presumptive probation according to the sentencing guideline. I went to prison on all of them. I could not get through probation, and that happened really quickly. Within 12 to 18 months, I had violated my probation enough times that they revoked my suspended sentence and sent me to prison. It happened really quickly because I made a decision not to stop using drugs, not always because I committed additional crimes, but because I wouldn't stop using drugs and alcohol. From the time that I was 19 years old until I was 32 years old, I never successfully completed probation for 13 criminal convictions. I got out of prison the last time in 2003 and entered into Minnesota Adult and Teen Challenge. And having a year in prison and a year at Teen Challenge really helped to heal my brain and helped me to really start to believe that I deserve something different and that my life could be different. I've been to prison 3 different times, and I'll talk a little bit more about that when I testify on the alternatives to incarceration bill. The thing that I just want to encourage you guys to do is to really look at what's fair and what eliminates the disparities that we see regionally and in communities of color. My husband was given 40 years of probation on a conspiracy to manufacture methamphetamines charge in Hennepin County. He is Caucasian and educated and really worked hard to come out from underneath that. After 4.5 years of probation in Hennepin County, he was released from probation 36.5 years early. I have another friend, Mark, who got a 4th DWI in a county that we've talked about a few times over the last 2 days, and he ended up having to do 6 of those 10 years for a DWI. You guys heard from Jen yesterday, it'll be 20 years before she's even eligible in Wright County to get an early discharge from probation. So the disparities in probation lengths and policies from county to county makes for not a very just or fair system. As a director at Minnesota Adult and Teen Challenge, I work a lot in the criminal justice system with county attorneys, with probation officers, with parole agents, and public defenders. You may think that what Jen talked about, 40 years of probation, or my husband, 40 years of probation, is the exception to the rule, and I'm here to tell you that it's not. We at Teen Challenge are considered a diversion from incarceration in the criminal justice system, and we see 20, 30, and 40 years of probation regularly, weekly, for the clients that come through our program. And I just really want to encourage you, I want to plead with you to really consider offering shorter probation sentences. That could mean that our probation officers would supervise fewer individuals, and then we could focus our limited financial and manpower resources and time and attention on the inmates, our returning citizens that need that extra time and attention. To ensure that our communities are protected and that our returning citizens achieve success. So,
thank you, Ms. Evans. Representative Long. Well, actually, are there any questions for these testifiers? Right, Representative Long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That completes my presentation.
Very well. Are there any questions for the author of the bill? Representative Moeller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Long. This might be more for House research if you don't know the answer, but I had a question about page 2, lines 2.3 to 2.5, that says that this doesn't prevent the court from imposing a sentence for a felony conviction within the limits provided for misdemeanor or gross misdemeanor. Would those, if it's a felony conviction, and the court sentencing to a misdemeanor, gross misdemeanor, under the way the law operates now, it's considered a downward durational departure, and the court has to find factors to make that happen. And I just wanted to clarify that the court would still need to find those factors in order to decrease that sentence.
Representative Long, it would be good to have that on the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Moeller, thanks for the question. That's the intent. The intent was to not is to make clear that we're not changing the ability to allow courts to give sentences for that are consistent with misdemeanor, gross misdemeanors for felony convictions. It's not intended to change the current operation of downward departures.
Thank you. That helps. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any further questions? Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a technical kind of question, too. So it says that any other state agency can be required to integrate the data with the Sentencing Guideline Commission. So which other agencies are you envisioning to be a part of that?
And Representative O'Neill, what page reference is that? I'm sorry, I thought you were reading off of the bill. You are.
Okay. I am, but let's see here.
Mr. Chair.
Why don't we ask our House Research to help us here? Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, members, I believe she's referring to Section 3 and specifically the new language at page 3, line 11 of the bill.
Okay. Thank you. And perhaps Ms. Mitchell might be able to help as well. Representative Long, please. Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the question, Representative O'Neill. So the goal here, I think, is just for some of the data that may need to be collected, giving them the flexibility to work with other agencies. I don't have a particular agency in mind. It may be that Director Mitchell might have one.
Ms. Mitchell.
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill, thank you. The Commission currently has a data integration with the judicial branch, and most of the data that half of the data that they receive comes from the judicial branch. That's the sentencing information that comes in. Then they also have the statewide sentencing worksheet data, and that's what the probation officers enter. Combined together, that's their current database. If they were to expand to get some more of this data, the things that I would imagine that they might have to do would be to get more data from the courts, what happens after sentencing. The statewide supervision system, which is housed at DOC, contains revocation reasons for probation. And then the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension has recidivism, the criminal history information. So I'm not saying that's what would happen, but those are possibilities that I'm aware of that they might need to go to.
Thank you. That helps.
Thank you. Very good question, Representative O'Neill. Thank you. Any further questions? Representative Johnson. Oh, I'm sorry. I jumped over. I'll get back to you. Representative Edelson and then Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Long, I just wanted to thank you for bringing up these bills from yesterday and today. I was honestly shocked to learn about some of the disparities. I think many of us from the public or people that are not as familiar with probation guidelines, that we don't have them. And so I thank you for your advocacy in this area. I'm a strong supporter.
Thank you, Representative Edelson. Representative Johnson.
I want to give, or Mr. Chair, I want to give Representative O'Neill a heads up. When I read this bill earlier, I did not catch that. I think there's going to be quite a bit of cost to putting those programs together. I was just wondering if fiscal note had been requested.
Okay. All right. So that's. Oh, I didn't know this was here. All right, let's deal with, I'm sorry, we're trying to get my act together here. I don't believe a fiscal bill has been asked, but perhaps our fiscal analysts can share some information now.
Mr. Chair, it looks like line 3.11 could have some costs. I don't recall whether or not I put in a fiscal note request on this bill.
Okay. We'll certainly have time to be able to vet that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson. I had not put in a fiscal note request. One of the reasons was I know the Sentencing Guidelines Commission is still putting together their budget request and was going to see if there may be a request in their budget for some additional help for programming like this. But that, I think, would be a fair thing to find out.
And we're certain, and our intent is to lay this bill over, so we'll have time to be able to pursue that further. Any other questions? If not, Representative Long, I want to thank you. I want to thank your testifiers and for the conversation as well. And so the chair will now lay over House File 997 as amended for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. And with that, I'm going to ask Representative O'Neill to come forward for House File 1028. And as Representative O'Neill comes forward, I believe your motion will be to lay House File 1028 over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Is that correct?
Yes, thank you.
Very well. So Representative O'Neill so moves.
Thank you.
And Representative O'Neill, you have an amendment. I have the amendment.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I believe you have an amendment.
Right.
And Mr. Chair, I believe that there is a typographical error, and unfortunately with our email system, I can't pull that email back up, but Ben Johnson has it, so I apologize. I can't just tell you what it is. I can't retrieve the email. So.
And I think the point here is that this is an amenable amendment to you.
Yes.
And so why don't we have Mr. Johnson walk through the I should move the amendment. The chair moves the A1 amendment. Now I'm going to have Mr. Johnson walk through that. And members, in transparency's sake, I want to be clear that this amendment, in the chair's opinion, falls in that category under minor oral amendments in our committee rules that provides discretion for minor oral amendments and making sure that there's a written copy of the amendment given to the committee legislative administrator during the hearing. Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair and members, this is very technical, but bear with me for a second. First of all, this wasn't prepared in my office, so I'll pass the buck on that. But if you look at the amendment, which is the A19-0019 amendment, page 1, line 7 of that amendment, it refers to page 2, line 15 of the original bill and says delete new language 5 and insert new language 7. It should actually be page 2, line 13. So the proper amendment to this amendment would be that Representative Mariani moves to amend the A19-0019 amendment to House File 1028 as follows. Page 1, line 7, delete 15 and insert 13.
And so, and Representative O'Neill, this is your understanding and acceptable to you as well.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I believe this is just technical in nature to put it in the correct shape that it should be.
Absolutely. Members, all in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. The bill is amended before it. Representative O'Neill.
Mr. Chair, so we need to move the actual amendment now that we've amended the amendment. Technical.
Okay, I'm not hitting on all cylinders today. So members, so we did an oral amendment to the A19-0019 amendment, and we just voted on that oral amendment, and as I indicated, consistent with committee rules, my committee rule number 8. And so with that, now the A19-0019 amendment, as amended, is before us. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Now, Representative O'Neill, your bill is before us as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Chair, for bringing that amendment. This is, this bill came together very quickly, and the Chair and I had a nice conversation and realized that this program, as we just got the report back, was doing so well that we wanted to move this as quickly as we could. And so I thank you for getting it in kind of the shape that it's more than I could have anticipated. So I'm very grateful for the number in particular. So members, let me bring you back, because many of you are new and haven't heard the whole story. So let me tell you about the story of Alternatives to Incarceration grant program that we are looking at today. Back in 2015 or so, the Department of Corrections came in and began to explain to us some of the facts and figures behind some of the admissions to the different prisons throughout the state of Minnesota, and found, as I had stated earlier, that about 60% of those admissions in that year were due to technical violations and not because of a new crime that had been committed. So that was a little bit startling, and I immediately got to work. And I worked with Minnesota Adult and Teen Challenge, and I'm glad Gina is here today, and she'll testify a little bit, and also worked with the DOC. And we came up with this great idea, which is very simple in nature. It simply says that if you have someone that is on their path back to prison and that will be their sentence, they'll be returning back to prison because of technical violations, usually more than one. You know, it's very, very rare, I believe, to have someone go back to prison because they violated one technical violation. In any case, that this would give them an opportunity to kind of restructure their sentence and send them to hopefully inpatient treatment, but it wasn't as prescriptive as that. So it could be inpatient treatment. It could be other things that they felt would be helpful. As I had stated before, about 85% of those coming through our criminal justice system do have an addiction issue. That's kind of pervasive from arrest forward. You can find that in the prison system. It is 85 to maybe even 90%, depending on the given day of our prison population. And so this particular program focused on nonviolent drug offenders. So these were not a person's crime, but these are folks that are really just struggling with their addiction. And so this gives them an opportunity to say, instead of sending me back to prison, I will go to treatment, whether it's inpatient or outpatient. And as you will hear from Gina Evans from Minnesota Adult and Teen Challenge, for these chronic offenders or chronic addicts, inpatient works much better, and she'll explain why. I was blessed to work with Minnesota Adult Teen Challenge. I was a director there, and I saw firsthand time and time again the success of the program. So it was launched in 2018. We passed it into law in 2017. We have 2018 data, and we launched it in Anoka County, which is why I have the Anoka County folks here with us to give us the results. But the results, as I read them, to me were shocking. And I'm going to let them tell you that story, but it's an amazing story. So once I saw that, and that report has just come out of the data, I said we need to not just keep this pilot the same, but expand it in Minnesota. So I thank you, Chair, that you've expanded it even further than I could have imagined. So I look forward to getting this into law again and expanding this and helping more people. But with that, I'd like to hear from Anoka County on how it went in their county.
Welcome to the committee, gentlemen.
Mr. Chair, my name is Dylan Workington. I'm the Director of Community Corrections in Anoka County. First of all, before I say anything, I just want to say thank you to to Representative O'Neill for the idea. Thank you for the Department of Corrections, whom we partner with as a community corrections agency, and are consistently in consultation with regarding all of our programming. So we appreciate all the work that's behind this and the efforts to support community corrections and alternatives to incarceration. It's been a while that Minnesota departments have embarked upon evidence-based strategy education within our agencies. I think in Anoka County specifically, but also in the state of Minnesota, we are the best trained in approaches to alternatives than we've ever been in our history. We train our agents in effective alliance and how to engage people. We train them in motivational interviewing on how to create opportunities through communication and alternatives, and we train them in cognitive approaches that challenge criminal thinking. That includes assessments, that includes targeted interventions, that includes targeted conversations. And so our problem is really more about intensity of service availability and the ability to do this work with fidelity. And so the Alternatives to Incarceration grant opportunity was perfect for us because it gives us a great opportunity to practice those skill sets. And so we're very grateful for that opportunity. And Anoka County, just for reference, is the fourth largest corrections department in the state. We're a community corrections agency. We do full service. So on behalf of the Department of Corrections, we do supervised release, folks coming out of prison. We write pre-sentence investigations. We manage juvenile offenders. We have four different facilities within our department, three juvenile facilities and an adult workhouse. Like Hennepin County, like Ramsey County, Dakota would be, I think, the third, and we're the fourth largest. So we're right in that mix of full-service departments. So part of the issue is volume. We have 7,800 people on probation at any one given time. Many of them have mental health concerns. Many of them, as has been said earlier, have addiction concerns. And so always wanted to do better work. I can tell you from a director's perspective, a revocation and a return to prison is only a good thing when there's a public safety element at risk or when someone's going to potentially do themselves harm. So we want to always do the best work we can in the community to protect the community as well as to engage them in resources. So a statistic that may have come out in previous testimony is that we do know in Minnesota that we have very short incarceration rates in prison, making it very difficult for prison systems to give treatment. And so the community is a much better option because we have a lifetime to work with people. In essence, as far as we don't have a period of time that necessarily ends. We want to continue to do great work and engage people all the time. And so this was just a great opportunity for us to work more intensively with people. We do know that high-risk people take more intensity of services. We know that even from our work with methamphetamine that what we were lacking was intense levels of service, and I think Teen Challenge echoed that in that the length of time that you can work with somebody just in engagement, not length of probation necessarily, but just in engagement with them and the intentionality of that is humanizing, both humanizing and it's a type of engagement that makes change. And so we were able to glean from this grant much information, some things we already knew, but it was really affirming to us that if we had a smaller caseload size, even with people who were going to be recommended to go to prison, but we came back and we did an alternative and said, you know what, we're going to do something different here, that we were able to turn the tide. And so we had a small sample because we got, you start a one-year grant cycle, you start, you hire up to do it, and then by the time you start getting recommendations in, but we had 21 people that were headed basically either back to prison or they were, we were headed to recommend prison. And so 21 of those individuals, 90% of that group had prior revocations. And 36%, I believe, had even supervised release revocations, so coming out of prison. And of that particular small sample of 21, we had 62% that didn't go to prison. And so very limited, 90% of that group, even the failure part of the group, did not recidivate as well with a new felony type offense. And so we're excited to work with new tools all the time. And I have with me Corey Cohan from our department, who is the manager over that particular area. And he has a lot more data and statistics to give to the committee today. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wilkinson. Welcome, Mr. Cohan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I just want to take an opportunity to give you a little bit of information and background about the pilot project that we did. So Mr. Workington talked to you a little bit about how we came to be the first agency in the state to have the privilege of using these new dollars for this initiative. But I wanted to give you a little bit of information about what we built in our agency. And I'm not saying that this particular project could be replicated across the state. Everyone's got unique resources and differences, but I think our model might be a place to start for other agencies that are interested in doing something like this. So what we did, we recognized that we had a very challenging population, and the legislative mandate or the statutory authority for this talked about nonviolent substance abusing offenders who were either at risk to commit technical violations of supervision or had been committing technical violations. And we found that group in our agency tended to be a very high workload, high volume group that really taxes the resources of probation officers. These are folks that are continuing to struggle in the community with committing violations such as using chemicals, not showing up for meetings, not following through with programming directives, getting terminated from programs, et cetera. And historically, these are the kinds of folks that, to be frank, agents might get frustrated with and say, you know what, maybe it's time to tell the courts or go to the Department of Corrections and say, you know, this person just needs some accountability back in a correctional facility. And we also know, as Mr. Workington indicated, that these people are going to come back out. And when they come back out, there's a lot of resources and time and energy that's needed to plan for re-release, coordinate housing, figure out where the person's going to go, how can they be stabilized in the community. And it really creates additional workload and stresses on the entire system when we do that on a revolving basis. So what we did is we targeted individuals who our agents would typically recommend revocation on. So this is somebody, as I mentioned, is struggling in the community. And we said, instead of doing that, let's try something different. And so what we did is we worked with our courts, and we also worked with the Department of Corrections Hearings and Release Unit and looked at ways to restructure their existing probation or supervised release orders into a new program. And what our program focuses on is creating stability and structured living right away. So getting these folks, to the extent possible, out of the environments that they're in right now, the people that they're associating with, the using behaviors, and get them stabilized. And we're using bed space in our adult workhouse facility, which is a minimum security facility, to provide some housing for these individuals. So we bring those folks into our workhouse facility as almost a transitional housing type of placement, and we do expedited chemical assessments and get these folks referred and directed into treatment as quickly as we can. And what we found is by doing this, we're getting folks into treatment on average of about 15 to 16 days from the moment they walk in our door. And that is a lot faster than historically happens on caseloads. And so that's been a good thing for us. In addition, we're doing intensive case management work with these folks. We have a case manager who's a substance abuse assessor who's able to do these assessments. She's working very closely with the probation and parole officers, coordinating case plans, release plans from our facility. We are also focusing on cognitive behavioral interventions, helping folks to recognize how their thinking affects their actions and leads them to criminal behavior. And so what we're finding is by providing that structure and stability and expedited treatment, we're seeing some good results. And Mr. Workington highlighted a few of those for you. We're in our second year. We were granted a second year of this grant. We're very excited about that. And we've already got 13 people in a month and a half. So we will well exceed what we did last year. And we're very optimistic that it's going to be a similar results. So if you have any questions for...
Super. Thank you, Mr. Cohen and Director Workington. We do have... other testifiers, but very quickly, I was going to do this as a question, but I won't. I'll do it as a statement. You can just sort of nod your head. Representative O'Neill and I have had this conversation, which is, you know, the program has only been around for a short period of time. And typically we want to see, I think, you know, a longer period of time to see whether or not these numbers are holding up. But I think what I'm hearing here is that given the population, high-risk revocation population, if you will, and given the huge percentage outcomes that we're seeing at this point, you're feeling very strongly confident you've got a working model here that can continue to work and could possibly also work in other places as well. Just a quick nod or yes would be great for the record.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. If I may, part of Mr. Cohen mentioned the accountability piece. And accountability is a major factor in all of life. So I have children. I try to hold them accountable lovingly and guide them in a certain direction. But if I wait months and months and months for due process and for engagement, I've missed golden opportunities for change. And so one of the things that this program does that we didn't mention was more of a swift and certain approach. The engagement of the smaller caseload allows our agent to engage people at these small levels of problematic behavior and engage the discussion surrounding what's the thought process behind that negative behavior, so that we're actually more swift with guidance and we're more certain that something's going to happen. But that doesn't necessarily mean it's reincarceration, and that's the piece that is there. So how do we dosage a response that's in keeping with small levels of issues in order to guide people away from big issues and big problems? And that's what we're trying to do here. And so that's a pretty effective element for us.
Thank you, Director Workington. I'm going to ask the commissioner to come up really quickly because we're pushing the clock here. Commissioner Schnell.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I want to first thank Representative O'Neill and all the members for the bipartisan support of the Alternatives Program. We do stand in support of the Alternatives Program. We think it does become critically important as a way of helping us better manage these offenders who are either release violators or potentially probation violators. Ultimately, I think it's important that we ensure the delivery of the right resources to the right people at the right time and for the right reason. The Anoka Alternatives Project, with the small number that it has, but I think the general sense that ultimately it can achieve those outcomes more generally represents the proper delivery of those resources. I think what I really want to highlight is the fact that in the alternative, these people may have been sent back to our facilities for very short periods of time. And the reality is that our ability to effectively intervene for those periods of time, those 60 days, 90 days, we may not be able to have them access programming. So what's going to end up happening is they're going to go back to one of our facilities, sit idle for 60 or 90 or 120 days, only to be returned right back to Anoka County and still have fundamentally unmet needs. That's what I think is the smart portion of this. That's really, I think, what the future has to be if we want to do these types of corrections programming right and make a difference to the people that are in the system as well as to the safety of our communities. Thank you for the opportunity.
Very well. Thank you, Commissioner Schnell. And Representative O'Neill, because I blanked out earlier in the amendment, I just need to say for the record, so the amendment that we did then expands both increases the grant amount, but it also makes it possible for us to do a pilot program in a non-metro location as well. So I think a number of us feel strongly that, and this testimony I think strongly supports it, that there's something good here that we can continue to look at in terms of working in other parts of the state. So with that, we have just seconds left, members. And so I'm wondering, Representative O'Neill, we're going to lay this over, but any quick thoughts for committee members?
So I just encourage, you know, that we would put this in, the omnibus bill. It's shown incredible results, as much as 61 to 62% reduction in returning back to prison and recidivism for very high-risk offenders. So it's something we definitely want to continue. It's going to be in the pilot program at least for a little bit till we can really look at more results, but I'd encourage us to put it in and fund it. So thank you. And I wish we had time for Teen Challenge. So another time we'll have to hear from Gina Evans again from Minnesota Adult and Teen Challenge.
We'll make sure that happens. With that, the chair lays House File 1028 as amended over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you, Representative O'Neill, and thank you to the testifiers. And with that, members, we stand adjourned until tomorrow.
Nice to meet you.